hello. My name is Tori Parker.
I'm Erin Mace.
And today I'm interviewing Helen Evans, who served during World War II. I am here with Todd Sheen, Ellie Williams, Carson Evans, and Sarah Egge. And today is March 1st, 2016. We are recording this interview in Helen's home. Today we will be discussing her experience in the WAC and her experiences during World War II.
Okay. So first off, Helen, so when were you born and where did you live? Where did you grow up?
I'm a Kentuckian, but I was born in Indiana.
So,
were you too? Good. Good. Mm-hmm. What part?
New Albany.
Well, I went to Central Indiana. Mm-hmm. My grandparents lived on a farm, and my mother went home to visit before my arrival time, except I decided I'd like to be a Hoosier, so I arrived early, mm-hmm. although my parents were living here in Lexington. My father was mm-hmm. with the University of Kentucky okay. in academia.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of your family, who were your family members?
I had parents. Vanita was my mother, Vanita Thomas Holliker, mm-hmm. married name. My dad was Levi Jackson Holliker, Horlacher, mm-hmm. German name, and spelt many different ways, but in our case, mm-hmm. the way I mentioned it. And I had one sister. I still have the one sister, mm-hmm. and she's 7 years younger.
So, what were you doing before the war?
I was a graduate of the University of Kentucky in home ec education.
Okay.
And much to my surprise, in order to cinch an A in student teaching, we were required to have an interview. Mm-hmm. And my interview, one became available. This was in 1941 at Versailles High School, which was a very large home ec department, large enough that it had two full-time home economics teachers. So I went for the interview begrudgingly because I wanted to remain the last semester as a senior in school along the way, never dreaming, of course, that I'd actually get offered the position. Mm-hmm. And so being offered the position, and in this case, as I indicated, a strong home ec department, it had one of the highest salaries available for women in Kentucky on teaching home ec. So I forgave my last semester of college, mm-hmm. having enough credits to already graduate, and became a home economics teacher, and that's what I was doing in 1941 when Pearl Harbor came along. That's the date which the United States joined in the conflict, primarily for the European theater.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember where you were when you found out about Pearl Harbor?
I sure do. our family had been to Indianapolis to see Sonia Henney, who was a well-known ice skater that was performing there. Exciting thing, and of course spent the night with my grandparents who lived in the county adjoining mm-hmm. Indianapolis in Hancock County. So we were returning home on the Sunday. In those days, cars didn't all have radios and you didn't have means of communication, mm-hmm. but we stopped in Shelbyville to refill the tank of gasoline. Mm-hmm. And in so doing, there was so much excitement. This is Shelbyville, Kentucky, not Indiana. Mm-hmm. We'd already been through that one. Mm-hmm. And they were so excited they'd heard that we'd been bombed in Pearl Harbor. And nobody knew where Pearl Harbor was, never heard of it, didn't know a thing about it, but there were people already in the service station that were sure they'd seen a Japanese person running down the street and that we were already invaded here in central Kentucky along the way. So that's where I was when I first heard about it. And of course, people were anxious to get home and turn on the radio. We were limited in the number of stations and your radio were not available for all day listening. Mm-hmm. You had only certain hours with a program or for certain news programs. But that was the experience I had on it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Going back just a little bit, what were your experiences in the, you would have been pretty young at this point, but in the 30s and during the Great Depression leading up to your education at UK?
What was my?
Your experiences in the 1930s.
In the 1930s? Well, primarily a high school student, mm-hmm. very active in campus activities. Seemed to have been kept busy. I don't know whether my parents felt that was a good procedure for raising a young lady or not, but they saw to it that I had opportunities for dance class, for music class, for dramatics or other subjects that might not have been offered in the school systems. Mm-hmm. So I was busy off hours as well as as during hours, and did a lot of volunteer work. I look back at it now and I find myself surprised that I helped with a vacation Bible mm-hmm. school in, for instance, the lower income area of Lexington, which at that time Davis Bottom, located there where Lexington's High Street and Maxwell Street intersect.
Mm-hmm.
I helped with a Bible school there. And that elementary school mm-hmm. was named Lincoln Elementary. Mm-hmm. And the elementary school I went to in Lexington myself was Jefferson Davis. And now with our discussion as to who should be recognized and how so from the Civil War, it makes it quite interesting that at one time Lexington had an elementary school recognizing both sides of the mm-hmm. of the issue.
So growing up, and I guess leading up until the war, I don't think that's good about this, when you joined the Women's Army Corps, how did that happen? How did that come about?
Long story, mm-hmm. maybe I can shorten it a little bit, but again, the radio programs were kind of few and far between, but we had read in the Lexington paper, and I say we, I'm now talking about teachers at Versailles High School, and we were in the teacher's lounge for a break, and all commenting that we'd heard that Congress had just approved in mid-May 1942, mm-hmm. Having a group of women known as Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, later became the Women's Army Corps, mm-hmm. To serve, similar to what the British were doing, who had been in combat for at least 3 years at that point in time. And so we decided it might be interesting to apply and see if mm-hmm. any of us would be accepted, because you had to apply, whether you wanted to be an enlisted or whether you wanted to go for a commission. You still would have to go to school to be a commission. It wouldn't be a direct commission mm-hmm. as such. We only had one person in the whole WAC that was a direct commission, and that was Evita Culp Hobby, who was the director of the Women's Army Corps, and she was a direct appointment,
mm-hmm.
Came in because she had political connections, but she knew her way around on various things. Mm-hmm. Her husband had been former governor of Texas. Mm-hmm. She was a journalist. She was active in mm-hmm. state government in Texas, but she was the only direct commission. So everybody else, even though people were trying to pull rank, so mm-hmm. to speak, and get appointments for their person to go ahead and be commissioned, the Army refused to do it, and everyone had to go through. Now, nurses coming in did not have to go through officer training. They were being commissioned directly as a second lieutenant. Mm-hmm. They were a commissioned officer rather than a non-commissioned officer coming in. So the three of us mm-hmm. borrowed a car. Versailles is only 13 miles from Lexington, but we didn't have access to a car. Of course, we were poor teachers starting out. And so we bummed a car and had to come to the nearest federal building, which was located at Lexington, in order to get the application forms mm-hmm. and information on applying. And we had only a 2-week window in which to do that. So we hustled along. We all three filled out the applications. And I went on then to summer school because mm-hmm. I had started the previous summer in graduate school at the University of Wisconsin in home ec education, realizing mm-hmm. if I was going to go on in teaching and so on, that a master's degree in Wisconsin mm-hmm. was an extremely strong school in that area. So I felt very fortunate, but I was ready to go for my second summer session to mm-hmm. Wisconsin. I got word just before I left, while I was still teaching, that I had been accepted for the application for the Women's Army Corps. Now, in order to do that, I had been through three different processes. We had to have a physical, and that's where you're Fort Thomas, one of you, I believe, Fort Thomas. Mm-hmm. Well, that was an active military base.
Right.
That's the place where they ask you where you were from, and then then before you had a chance to say, they'd say, oh, well, we know you're Kentucky, because I would say, when they say, jump on one foot 10 times, jump on the other foot 10 times, I would say right or left foot. And they said, you have to be from Kentucky. That, because then I would have asked, was shoes on or shoes off, you know? In other words, the directions were hazy, just jump, you know? So we always laughed about Fort Thomas and the lack of exacting directors. So you had your physical. If you passed that, then you'd have the mental test. And the mental test was in Louisville. Where we left that. So if you passed those two, then you had a personal interview. And those of us from Kentucky were sent to Columbus, Ohio, which was the headquarters of our service command. The United States was divided into 13 service commands.
Mm-hmm.
And we fell in the one under the jurisdiction out of Fort Hays at Columbus, Ohio. And if you passed the interview you were in, an interesting thing happened on the interview because I knew which cubicle I was going to be assigned. They'd already told me. I was going down to cubicle 9, for instance. And I looked to see who were the interviewers. And lo and behold, I knew one of them. Dean Sarah Blanding had been Dean of Women at the University of Kentucky, and I had worked strongly with her when I'd been the university's president of the students at UK, the women's students. So I sent word to the information desk. You'd think I was trying to get out of it or something, but that I actually knew Dean Blanding, mm-hmm. and perhaps they might want to consider shooting me into another interview unit, mm-hmm. So they apparently asked Dean Blanding, and she shot back the words, "There are three of us on the committee, and the other two, if they don't care for her, they can override me in voting." So I went ahead, and mm-hmm. the other two, one was a career Army person, mm-hmm. and the other was a professional business person. Both happened to be males. Mm-hmm. And Dean Blanding went on and became president of, or she at the time actually had already moved, she was president of Vassar University. She'd okay. left the University of Kentucky and become president of Vassar. So those were the three interviews that you had.
What kind of questions did they ask you?
I have no idea what they asked me. I just remember when I came home and told my parents, came home on the weekend, and mm-hmm. here I lived in Lexington, actually, and I told my mother at the dinner table, those are the days when you ate dinner with your family every night and you talked about everything good and all the things not so good that happened during the day. So I told her that I had applied for the Women's Army Corps. And my mother jumped up out of the chair screaming, "You'll be killed, you'll be killed," and so on. I have no idea what my dad did because he was so busy trying to calm my mother down. And as I look back on it, very rightfully so, see, this was 1942. We'd had the war since the beginning of December the 7th, 1941. And my mom had friends here in Lexington, two of whom had already had their sons killed in combat. So this was a very real thing. I mean, joining the military was serious business. And so the tragedies were there. I will say that as time went on, my mother became quite a supporter of having women in the military. And the governor appointed her to the state committee on women to represent the recruiting for women in Kentucky to join the WAC. And she joined it and was quite active in it and so on. So once she got accustomed to the mm-hmm. idea, she would point out the values mm-hmm. and the pitfalls of perhaps going into this brand new thing that we'd never had here, officially a women's unit.
So what was your kind of inspiration to join the Women's Army Corps? Was it just this like willingness to serve, or was it a way to like progress yourself?
As I said, I was the summer of 1942, I was a student graduate work at the University of Wisconsin. And as always happens on lots of these cases, I'd met a young man who was a Wisconsin person in med school. And we always had great conversations and so forth. So it was a great problem when I got two telegrams in one day. Telegrams were the way of communication. You didn't have cell phones. You couldn't pick up the telephone and text somebody or something. They were the yellow printed out telegrams. And I got two in one day. And one of them said, "You've been accepted for the Women's Army Corps." This is June 1942. "You've been accepted to join it, and you are to report August 1st. The other one said, "You've been granted a graduate assistantship at Northwestern University, and you are to report such and such." I was changing my major from home education. I was shifting to college administration and personnel. And at that time, Northwestern was one of about three strong schools in that area of endeavor. And so I was quite flattered and pleased mm-hmm. to have been accepted. So I had the decision, because I'd already been offered mm-hmm. and had signed a contract, actually, to return to teach at Versailles for the fall of 42. Mm-hmm. So I had three things to decide. And my friend, was a great listener and so on. Mm-hmm. He was in med school, had another year to go or two, and had already, in order to stay in school, had signed for the Navy. And if you signed for the military branch, they often would allow you to finish your engineering courses or your medical courses, mm-hmm. which the military could use you as a trained person for. So that was my big decision, and mm-hmm. obviously the decision was everybody's going to be doing something. This is an all-out war. Mm-hmm. Children are going to be doing something. They're going to be collecting foil. They're going to be up down the streets. Rationing was already in effect. People were doing without silk. Well, they didn't have silk hose. They were primarily rayon hose. You know, you don't remember, but your great-grandparents would, that mothers would remember. There was a seam up the back of the stocking. That's where the rayon was sewn together for the hose. It wasn't just a tube as such. Well, when you couldn't buy and you're a college student and you can't buy something to cover your legs that is available, no hose. Pantyhose hadn't really come in at that point. It was all garter hose. You had a pen, like for your eyebrow pen, and mm-hmm. you'd take that and you'd line up the back of your leg so you'd have your seam showing. And it would look like, and she used the tanning lotion, and then you'd have the seam up the back of your leg for. Well, that was a big thing, you know. I remember after the war, always saying to people, so on, just be sure when I get old that one of you tell me if my seams are straight or my hose. Because to me, older women often would have the baggy hose. They couldn't get them pulled up right. It was the type of fabric that we had at that point, which was super, but it wasn't like it is now and ease. And so your hose would be wrinkled. So that was my experience on then having to decide, because as I say, everybody else was going to be doing something. I might as well gamble for the unknown, and it had interest and appeal to me.
Do you think your attitude towards the war was different than maybe some of the other teachers that you worked with, other women who did not apply?
Yeah, women are all different in what they mm-hmm. like, what their interest. Mm-hmm. Some are a little more daring. Mm-hmm. I kind of believe if you don't take a risk, mm-hmm. you haven't gained anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it may fall flat, but at least you've given it a go. And I don't think all women had that attitude. Mm-hmm. And not all women really adapted it. But the same thing I think is true of men. A lot of men don't adapt to the group living and the routine. It's very difficult when you've been used to making your own calls and somebody's telling you exactly what you're going to do at 2:00 that afternoon and where you're going to be at 5:47 and a half. That later that afternoon on the parade field or whatever it is, mm-hmm. because somebody else is controlling your activities. Mm-hmm. Just as a side, I think that's one of the problems right now when people get out of the military. Mm-hmm. They have been so acclimated mm-hmm. to someone telling them where they need to be at what time and what you're going to do mm-hmm. that the readjustment back to the civilian life becomes quite a stressful activity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it's any different now than it was back then. People had difficulties in adjusting, and I think that's one of the reasons.
So you reported August 1st, 1942?
I reported August 1st, 1942, and there were 11 of us in our group. Mm-hmm. We were assigned to the second officer candidate class. From the original pool of interviews, they had created about four classes of women. The first class had started mid-July, and we were starting later, but we were all selected at the same time, which class and when we would report. So mine was, and we went through the Cincinnati recruiting office to go into it. So we became part of what you call the 5th Service Command, and the number that I was assigned for the military started with the number 5. So you could look at any of the WAC women, and you can tell what area of the country they were inducted by the first number of their identifying code.
So August 1st, 1942, what were some of the other women like, the other 11 women in your unit?
Very, very capable. I just find myself amazed that I had the opportunity to be with such outstanding group. Granted, see, when I applied, I hit just the minimum age, 21. So I thought I was an out to start with. And then meeting all these women, because most of them had been careers. They had been CEOs of businesses. They had had strong leadership in their career. And most of them were older. Our oldest, I think, was 35, which was about the top on age. Her husband was a full colonel at Fort Knox, and they had no children. And so we all called her, since she was our class, we called her Mama Matuska, her last name Matuska. So she was like a mama to us because she was old. She was 35 along the way. Right.
Could you tell in a difference of attitude between the Women's Army Corps, all these women who volunteered, and the men who were drafted? What was the difference in attitude maybe between these two groups?
Well, I bet you could jump to that conclusion right off. The very first thing is, what man wanted some woman to come in and take his place so he had to go fight in combat? Mm-hmm. So you might not be the most popular person showing up on the scene, because the object of the women in the military mm-hmm. was to replace a man for active duty. So that meant the women were coming in to be trained for all these jobs that women could do, as well as men. But you see, the men were accustomed to being they were the secretaries, they kept the minutes, they did a lot of things that we sometimes thought of as more a female occupation. The telephone operators, the women could take over all the telephone operators. They learned truck repair, maintenance. I mean, they're just anything, lots of things that they could do. So that, I would say, for a lot of men, that was very alarming. Mm-hmm. I think we would all find that if your jobs are threatened. I don't know that it would hang over into other areas, whether it's race coming in or whether it's your age or whether it's your gender, just what.
So what was your training like here before you went over?
Our training was shorter than the male training, because we had eliminated a lot of the arms, that is the shooting, the weaponry and so on. We had training, but we were not permitted to carry a gun along the way. So we had the same classes that men did, basically, in officer training, with the elimination. So that put us to a 6-week training instead of a 12-week or so on. I think it cut it about in half, eliminating the actual combat instruction. But we had the usual PE, the usual marches, the usual equipment, everything down the way.
What did you excel in particularly?
Probably, I don't think I was the smartest one around. I think what I excelled in was realizing that and hopefully maybe making other people feel like that they had some talents and abilities there. I don't know, but looking back 70 years ago, I kind of think that might be true. And that's so long ago, I don't really know that there was anything, truthfully.
So training was that in Cincinnati? Is that where you were?
Actually, the training for the WACS was at Fort Des Moines, Iowa.
Okay.
The Women's Army Corps had taken over what had been a military base in the city. From World War I, you had a lot of towns that had military bases. Mm-hmm. For instance, Indianapolis had the one at Fort Benjamin Harrison, right there at the edge of Indianapolis. Cincinnati had Fort Hayes right in the middle. Fort Des Moines, Iowa was located in the middle of Des Moines, Iowa. Des Moines had been a training center for blacks. It had been a training center for cavalry. Again, realized that we were pretty much horse operated up until the time of World War II, and then we got the tanks and other armored. But it was a whole shift in those 20 years between World War I and World War II as to the type of warfare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So during your training, you knew you were preparing to go over to Europe, right? Did you have any idea?
Not particularly to go to Europe. I was just preparing to take over a job
that.
The what men might have had.
Did you have any idea where you would be?
No. I received no promises, no anything. I think I basically was surprised that I was accepted in the beginning to come in. And later, when I worked in Washington one time, I did have access to my personal records that were on file in one of the Quonset huts located on Connecticut Avenue. So temptation's right there, so you just pull it out and look at it. And they had written across the top of my application, very young but very capable. And I have to think that that comment is probably what brought me in as a younger person, because I was the very youngest. I had gotten to 22 by the time I was actually in the military, but all the applications had been at the minimum age of 21. I might add, I said something about the age of Mama Metusky being 35. You could not come into the WAC if you had children. So that is a big change here in the last 65, 70 years of the number of women that are in the military that have children under the age of 18. You could have children if they were over 18, but that meant that they were, of course, they were eligible for the draft and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. A different thing. But I think that's kind of a big interesting change now, because you have so many grandparents or parents that are helping raise the children while their sons and daughters are both in the military. So it's a whole different complexion, maybe a little bit, on who's helping raise a lot of our youngsters today, with so many more women. See, the number of women in the military keeps going up. It was 17%. I haven't seen anything lately to tell us if it's over the 20%, but that's pretty hefty percentage.
So what was your role after training? What was the next step?
In my big interview at Fort Hays, they'd asked me what I wanted to do in the Army. And I'm from Kentucky, and I had no idea what anybody did in the Army. I was only familiar that the University of Kentucky had what they called the Reserve Officer Training Corps. Being a land-grant college, all students at a land-grant school were expected to take military training, all male students. That was required for 2 years. Then if you wanted to go ahead and get a commission, you could remain the next 2 years, and at completion of 4 years, you'd come off with an opportunity for commissioning as a second lieutenant, graduate from the University of Kentucky. And that was the extent that I knew about the military. I think I've wandered off of course from your question. Inquiry there a little bit?
After training, what was your next step?
All right. Leading into that application that I saw, they quoted me as having said, when they asked me what I wanted to do in the military, being a home ec person, first thing I could think of, the military has to eat. So I spoke up and said, anything but foods. All right, now I'll give you a guess. What did I do for the 4 years?
Oh, no.
Foods. the Army immediately sent me to a baker's and cook school that was for male officers at Fort Riley, Kansas. And it was exactly that. I do have a fun picture from there, that we were wearing our baker's hats and learning of the skills of how the military does the cooking and everything. And so we'd have our lieutenant bar on our cap or so on. And one of the other women officers, a good buddy, we stood at the window because the bakery had bars on the window. And I don't know whether that was to keep the soldiers out from coming in to find good donuts or what, but at any rate, they had bars, so we said we had the women back of the bars there. Anyway, and so from there, then I was sent to teach women. Our women units were separate. This is another big change in 70 years. In the 1970s, women were integrated in with the male units. Mm-hmm. Now then, they are still integrated with the units, but up until that time, until the 70s, your company of women might be 250 women, and a company of men, 250. So the women had to train their cooks to cook for them, you see. And it was important, because it wasn't a commercial enterprise like we have in Afghanistan and Iran now, of commercial companies coming in and cooking. It was done by the military personnel themselves. And so I was sent to teach our WACs, helped establish another WAC training center, which was at Fort Polk, Louisiana, the fifth WAC training center, which we didn't keep for long. But interesting there is the space we were allocated, because space was such a premium in these military bases. So the space we were given, what was constructed to be a prisoner of war complex, our troop ships would take troops overseas to Europe. Then they would come back empty. All right, we needed farm people. We needed people in the tobacco fields. We needed people in cotton fields, because we were drafting our fellows. Some of them got exempted for their agriculture pursuits, but lots of farm men were not. And so we needed help, so they hit on the idea, why do we work and try to feed the Italian prisoners of war? Remember, we went into Italy first before the actual European countries. Well, why do we try to, why don't we bring them back to the States? It's easier to feed them in the States, and then they can work on the farmland and we get a return, whereas we don't have anything for them to do if we keep them as prisoners of war in Africa and in Italy. So this complex at Fort Polk, it's now Fort Polk, it was Camp Polk then, was built to be a prisoner of war complex for Italian prisoners of war. And of course, you could already guess, we have the corner posts, the lookout towers, and we have all this barbed wire going around the top of the fences and so on. So the joke at Fort Polk was, is that barbed wire there to protect the women that are in the post or to keep the men out? What's the purpose of that barbed wire? But anyway, we had to take the mail facilities and redesign and convert them differently. Sometimes people are interested to know about the bathrooms and so on. Well, the male soldier has one big shower, you know, lots of shower heads. Mm-hmm. Women had a whole little different complex. They weren't so keen on that. Mm-hmm. And so accommodations were made to try to make more individual stalls, for example. The same thing was true with commodes. There was a whole different modesty set of comfort zone for the male and the female soldiers. So if we took over a male unit, which we often did, and we tried to make it as pleasant as you can for a rigid activity.
So that was Louisiana?
Louisiana, yeah. Then I was assigned to Washington, D.C. I'd been to Fort Meade to a special officer's course, and I'd also been sent to the Adjutant General School in Washington. So I found myself working with the head office of the Quartermaster General. And our project was to determine what percentage of food women ate in comparison to what was assigned for a male company of 250. Mm-hmm. So that involved a lot of a rigid survey, and I traveled the United States making inspections of different WAC units. And our end result in the beginning of 1944, it was completed, was that we would know how many pounds of potatoes a women's group should draw if the ration showed a certain number for the male. Now, we had smart mess sergeants. Mess sergeant is the person that coordinates kitchen activities. They knew how to trade with the male unit next door. You could trade your green beans down to get more potatoes, I mean, he could, or vice versa. And nobody looked, they looked the other way. But to make it official and so on, we had this master menu. And that was probably the biggest thing I was involved with. I worked with the civilian personnel that were assigned to the Office of the Quartermaster General, the professional dietitians. I was not a dietitian. I had not pursued that type of food backing, but I had access to the dietitians from Kellogg Company, from Post Company, and so on. They were all employed as civilians in Washington. Everybody's working on food. We're trying to get a ration that will travel, that will hold up. We weren't accustomed to having dehydrated foods. This was the first big introduction. You're going to have milk that you add water to make milk to drink. The first thing some of the soldiers wanted, certainly our women when we came back, I did, first thing I wanted was a glass of milk. I hadn't had a real glass of milk in all the time I'd been gone because I'd had this powdered stuff, which was wonderful. But that's what your quartermaster corps is working for, foods that will hold in these different temperatures, mm-hmm. different zones that will travel. Mm-hmm. Carson the other day sent me an article that was kind of interesting. Carson's my son, that has quite an interest in the College of Agriculture and Home Ec too, as a big sponsor and supporter. But it was an article about a colonel who had worked with the Hershey Company, trying to get the Hershey candy bar converted into a Ration D, making it a health bar for our troops. Well, they found out that the troops liked the sweets so well that they were just gobbling them up as if it was something sweet. But the colonel that was in charge of that happened to be the very colonel I worked with in Washington 70 years ago, and his name spelled out, Colonel So-and-so, and he had gone to the Hershey Company. You see, we pulled in from all of these food companies all over the United States. They're experts, they're dietitians, so on. But they found out that, he said, we've got to add something to that Hershey bar so it's not quite so inviting. Our fellows want to eat it all the time. It's something tasty. Long way. And I had no idea that the person I worked with had helped develop the Ration K, or D, I don't know if it was D or K, that was actually from the Hershey Company, so on. But just one aspect of how, and as the dietitians I worked with, they were from Kellogg Company. Mm-hmm. They were the ones that were starting to count the number of raisins that are in your cereal. So I've been privileged to watch lots of changes along the way, and I've enjoyed it over the years. So that was my job until the survey. Then I was sent to the European Theater to make inspections there. And I was there at the very end of the war, when the war for the European theater. Mm-hmm. And I was still there, waiting for shipment to the Pacific when the war was closed in August 1945. So then we were all being discharged.
Mm-hmm. So were you inspecting WAC units in Europe?
No. I was working inspecting the mail units. We didn't have very many WAC units as such. We had WACs there, too. Most of the WAC units that I was familiar with did not leave England. They were working with postal. Mail was a big morale issue, and it was. We had complete units that censored mail. They directed, redirected, and trying to get the mail as close as they could where they knew someone was, and having that awful job of returning mail and belongings if they were certain the person was a fatality along the way. So that was my career. I came home and got out of the military.
Mom, didn't you inspect German POW camps?
End, I did work with the German POWs, yes. That was. I worked with the women. There were women that traveled with the German army for other armies, not just the German, but that was a more or less a norm for a lot of the military units. And as the war was ending, we were capturing these women, and we didn't have any place to keep them. So I was stationed in the valley at the Rhine River, and we had a compound there that we created, which was directly above ground and so on, just women with fence around it and guards to keep them, hundreds and hundreds of them. And so I was involved with the feeding and working with that. I did have one fun experience, though, that I was no help in, but it brought smiles to everybody's face at the time. One of my associates, and I couldn't go anywhere without a male officer with me. See, I was not carrying a weapon while I was in Germany, so I couldn't go anywhere without the male officer. But anyway, he came running in, and he said, Captain Hollicker, come quick, one of the women's having a baby. All right, now you're looking at a 22-year-old who hasn't been out in the world and doesn't know much about deliveries and babies. Certainly it's not skilled nurse as such. So it turns out that our little arrival got the headlines in the newspaper, the Stars and Stripes Forever, as the youngest prisoner of war in Europe, and so on. And I've still got that clipping in that article upstairs. So I worked briefly with the prisoners of war, not in the prisoner of war camps. Mm-hmm. These were compounds outside of that. I mean, not where our troops were prisoners. I had a number of friends that did, and I don't imagine they've ever gotten over that experience of seeing their fellow soldiers and such, and country people in such bad shape. And
what was the most rewarding part while you were over there? Did you enjoy being over there?
I enjoyed it. It was a treat. Since I wasn't injured and hurt, I felt very fortunate on it, and I wouldn't take any for it. Now, I happened to have been a person that traveled a lot before I ever went in. Travel was great, but it happened to be something I enjoyed. Before I ever went into the military, before 21, my family, always on vacations, took terrible vacations, in my opinion, because we always had to get in the car and go somewhere. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the fun of going to my great-grandmother's camp up on Lake Michigan or something, you know, or something great in the summertime. No, we got in the car, and we visited every state in the Union. And my father was associate dean, university and ag college. We visited every college, land-grant college, across the United States. We not only visited the college, we also had to visit the state capitol. Mm-hmm. So I could tell you about any of them. So I had grown up traveling, mm-hmm. and I enjoyed it and liked it. So the military happened to give me that. I never dreamed that I would be even sent overseas as such. But I think that, but the women I met and the people, mm-hmm. I thought it was positively amazing. You just swell up with pride that there are all these capable people and their abilities and what they can do. So I felt very honored. And as I told them later, that I should have paid Uncle Sam for the opportunity to have gotten to serve for on behalf of the country.
Were any of the original 11, were you with any of them throughout?
I kept in touch with a couple of them, mm-hmm. along the way. They're going overseas. We were sent over on the QE2, the Queen Elizabeth II, I guess it was, which had been converted to a military ship. But we had learned while we were waiting back in to go overseas that three of us could sing together. So we developed a trio, and we called ourselves the Poor Man's Andrew Sisters. And we learned all the songs of the Andrew Sisters. So when we were on the ship going over, we were the entertainment.
Wow.
The Poor Man's Andrew Sisters. So it was the opportunity. And one of the threesome happened to be a girl from Louisville that I did keep up with. Unfortunately, malignancy caught up with her in the 1970s, so we lost her. But I have no contact with anybody that I was in service with. The last person I know of just died about a year and a half ago in Kansas, mm-hmm. and along the way. So I don't know. There are some, I'm sure, and I know some that women that have been in the military, but I didn't serve with them. Mm-hmm. Have I backgrounded you down, girls?
Mom, tell them about the Women's War Memorial, your involvement.
Oh, yeah, you might be interested in that. We went for a long time without having a memorial to either World War II veterans or to women that had been in the military. And I became involved on supporting the effort to obtain a women's memorial. There were lots of locations suggested in Washington, on the Mall locations, but finally the overall committee on beautification and the memorials committee in Washington decided that they would let us have what we were asking for, which was the rundown, beat-up front entrance to the Arlington National Cemetery, mm-hmm. which is the hemicycle, you know, it's in a semicircle entranceway. And that's your parade area, that's your big entrance to the cemetery. And so they said, well, yeah, it's fallen down, the eagles have fallen off the top, and the marble and all the rest of the things, let the women have it. So our aim was to take it, and we were successful. Colonel Levitt Cope, not Colonel Hobby, anyway, there is a current director. We had a design contest, and it was developed that there was added depth to the a semicircle wall. No graves were disturbed or so on, but we made room for a small kitchen. We have retirement ceremonies there. We have receptions for after interment of anybody or deceased event. Plus it's a museum, and it's a ceremonial entrance, and skylights were added, and I had the opportunity on behalf of the DAR, Daughters of American Revolution, of carrying one of the flags that were presented for the memorial. We had the state regents or presidents carrying all the flags, and then for the territories, they took women who were DAR members but had been in the military, and we were invited to carry a flag. I carried and presented the Puerto Rican flag. So when you go to the Hall of Flags there, each of the flags were presented by a different state to encompass it. But this is the women's memorial. General Vaught is the current and retiring general that created this, and it was in the late 1990s. And my son mentioning it, my daughter Ann also, all went to the ceremony for the dedication of the memorial. And I had the pleasure of climbing over the spiked wall that separates Fort Meade from the cemetery. You know, it has all those metal spikes on it. Well, they helped me, and I was just 85, so we went over the wall. And what we laugh about it, but I guess it was a little more than that, 85. What am I? I'm 95 now, almost 96 on age. So, but I also was on the committee for the World War II Memorial. I represented Kentucky. I think that was the point he made, that I had the opportunity. The governor appointed me, and I was co-chair of getting Kentucky with contributions on behalf of each of the women veterans in the state, and it's part of the overall marker there that Kentucky is included, which I think it would have been a shame if we hadn't been, but sometimes you can't get contributions quite when you want them. It sometimes seems ongoing.
So you were in Europe when the war ended?
I was in Europe when the war ended. Mm-hmm.
So what was it like to be in Europe when the war ended?
Well, where I was in Germany, we didn't even know the war was over. You know, as I say, we didn't have fast communication, and we didn't hear about it for quite a few hours afterwards and so on. So it was a big celebration. I might say somebody will ask if I was shot at any time, and only once while I was there. One of the Germans shot across the Rhine River, and I was standing up there. And so I was knocked down, and the person I was with fell on top, and so on. And so we were not hit, but it was fast thinking on their part too, because I wasn't accustomed to the bullets. So that's the only close endeavor that I had as far as misfortune shooting. Now, we had women that were injured, and we've lost women in combat. We've lost them in training along the way, so that's a big thing. But the World War II Memorial was also another big celebration, and we had a goodly number from Lexington that went on that. And probably the big activity right now is we have two groups that handle honor flights from Kentucky. An officer, Air Corps fellow, wanted to treat his World War II dad to an experience of going back and seeing the World War II Memorial, since it came so late in the lives of the World War II people. And so he and one of his fellow flyers decided to take their dads for a one-day trip to Washington, they both being pilots, and they flew up, and their dads enjoyed the one-day trip so much that they decided it ought to be offered to other people. And Kentucky participates in that. And just this year, we had our first all-women flight, which would be veterans from World War II onward, mainly onward, I think, on that. And it went out from the Tri-County, Cincinnati area. But that's the first time that we've ever had. And at the World War II Memorial, Senator Bob Dole attempts to be there every Saturday, and he was the senator, the World War II veteran, that was one of the big movers and shakers to get the memorial. And if he's in the D.C. area, he makes a point of being there and circulating and howdying with any of the families and the World War II veterans that are there at the World War II Memorial. Now, you know, the new World War II Memorial expands the reflecting pool between Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument and so on. And my big contribution, which wasn't big, but I insisted on writing letters saying, let's don't block the water. Let's put it off to the side some way, which they were very smart. They did that, and it's very effective. But I didn't think anything should block the vista between the two memorials. Mm-hmm. So it's in a wonderful spot, and representing Pacific Theater on one side, and on the other side of the water is the European Theater. Have any of you been there? Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to get you all to Washington. I think all history classes need trips and tours to D.C., and they can do that. You can fly up in the morning. I'll come along as a little genie guide. and we'll leave out early in the morning, and we spend the day, and go kind of like the honor flights, with the honor flights of the veterans, and they have a guardian with each of them going. So we've got a couple that are scheduled coming up this spring. and they're very exciting because you're so well met at the Louisville Airport. They have hundreds of people that come out with flags. They have refreshments. They get T-shirts. I mean, it goes all out. You get caps, so on. But for health purposes, they have a guardian with you if you're in need of bathroom assistance, health assistance, and the guardians pay their own way. But the passengers, the veterans, are gifts from people and organizations, businesses. So that's known as the Honor Flight. So that's a current big movement you might read about this spring coming up. We'll have to get the dates for you. You might be able to go over and bid them bon voyage. We had one go out from Lexington instead of Louisville. And the weather was exceedingly bad, and I was having some problems, so didn't try to go out. But I understand we had several thousand people there at 11 o'clock at night to greet our returnees coming back in for one day trip.
Speaking of that, what was your return home like from Europe? So you were in Germany when it ended, and how long did you stay
I was puzzled. I have no idea what to do. Uh-huh. I'd been busy. I'd been one of those not necessarily being told too much what to do, but establishing what needed to be done at what times, and I didn't have anybody involved. And I think I really missed it. I really wondered what was happening. I went on a trip to New Orleans, to the Mardi Gras, and did things like that. Well, I was invited to make a speech representing women veterans at a dinner here in Lexington. It happened to have been a Presbyterian church. And they asked one of their members, who was a male and one who was a female, to bring greetings of returnees for the group. And so mine was the woman who was selected. They didn't have much choice. There were just two of us from the whole congregation. Out of 149 people, only two of them were women that had been in the military along the way. But in the group was the director of the Veterans Hospital. And he knew that the Veterans Administration in 1946 was going to be expanding with a new thing called the GI Bill of Rights. And one of those areas was education for veterans, and a lot of us probably have family members that were able to take advantage of it. My husband took advantage of that, and he came back and finished his degree in school through the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. And the director, Harry Farmer, here at the time, knew they were going to move the regional office from Lexington to Louisville to break it away from the hospital so it wouldn't be all considered hospital. And he said, After the program came up, and he said, "Helen, I don't know what you're going to do." He said, "But I think there's a job going to be opening up that you might qualify for, I'll bet." And he said, "You go down to the federal building and pick up such and such and see if it has any appeal to you." He says, "We're going to be hiring. I'm going to be hiring five people." And so he thought that he could put one of those five as a woman, which would not look too bad on his record either, I guess, but nevertheless, I got the opportunity. So I took the job and worked out of Louisville, and I worked with training veterans below the college level. That would be your business schools, beauty schools, funeral homes, funeral directors, and any type of special school that a veteran might have, and helping coordinate it. So I was what they called a senior training officer and worked out of that. And I stayed there until I married and started a family. And then we were moved, then my husband took a job in Lexington, and we moved from Louisville to Lexington. I've been here ever since.
This is interesting, but I like this question a lot, the sights and sounds that you remember the most from your time?
Sights and sounds. Mm-hmm.
Especially
I don't have anything. I guess those donuts cooking in Fort Riley might have been a favorable odor and so forth.
What about Paris?
What?
You spent time in Paris. Paris, France.
Oh, what experiences in Paris?
Yeah, the sights and sounds of Paris,
oh,
France.
Yeah. I was thinking actually on the military field too. No, on leave vacation, yes. Mm-hmm. Lots of interest and fun, for instance, having been able to get a leave several times. Well, actually, I was stationed in Paris a couple of times, so I was right there. But that was intriguing, and I certainly remember that well and felt very fortunate on it. And I'd had leave also in Switzerland.
Wow.
I had a little difficulty when I was going across the border into Switzerland, though, on my leave, because my maiden name was Holliker, which is a German name. And they knew a lot of Hollikers there, and the people that were working, they said, we've got them in Switzerland, we've got them in Germany, and so on. Who are you? What are you doing? And could you be? And that was a possibility, because I actually dated a fella that impersonated an officer one time while I was stationed in Washington several times. And one of the times, on a Sunday afternoon date, and I was with a lieutenant, and that evening, by 9 o'clock, on our apartment there in Virginia, where three of the officers, we had our own apartment at the time. I was the junior officer. They were higher rank at this point in time. Well, the FBI came to find out about the person I'd been with that afternoon. And they tracked us down because we took a picture in one of those little automatic photo machines where you get a strip of pictures of yourself. And so they had tracked me down. Well, my two roommates, both of whom were now colonels, and I was just a lousy captain. They had to go to the other room, the bedroom. They said they cracked their ear at the door to hear what was happening and what was happening. But he was impersonating an officer, and he was not in the military. And I didn't pick up on that. I looked at the picture, and all of a sudden it hit me. He had one of his pins upside down. I mean, that in itself should have clued me that there was something wrong, because he could have gotten, I don't know, court-martialed or not, but he could have been well reprimanded for wearing a uniform. And I didn't even pick up on that. And whatever happened to him, I don't know. And nothing ever happened to me, so. But I did add excitement, and we all had lots of laughs over that later.
Mm-hmm. What was your uniform like?
Uniform. Oh, girls, you would have loved that uniform. Summertime, it was heavy khaki. In the wintertime, it was sticky wool. We wore hose all the time. In the summertime, we did not wear pants as such, unless you were working in motor corps or something. But even for physical ed, we wore elastic-type bloomers with a skirt that came around, seersucker, brown and white seersucker, button skirt, and the bloomers things. And then you just unbutton your skirt for your exercises when you had them, and so forth. But women were not into wearing pants as part of an everyday uniform. So you see early pictures of women marching in formation. They actually were marching in skirts. We had high-top shoes that laced. They're trying to copy them now and sell them to you for $430. But they actually laced up and supported, and that was your field shoe, and then you had another shoe. And as an officer, you could have a dress shoe, a type of a low heel pump to wear. As I say, cotton hose. Unfortunately, I think we were pampered as much as could be, because if there was anything new and available, they got us that as far as clothing is concerned. I think of the WAC was the first of the military, Women's Army. Then we had the Navy. And those were called the waves, women in some sort of voluntary service. I don't know if they made it go with the word waves and so forth. But girls, they had the edge on us. They had Schiaparilli design their uniforms. Now, you can't beat a navy and a white to look snappy and look good versus women that are wearing olive drab, similar to our photographer's color today, his shirt, and maybe in camouflage. We don't really look quite as good as those Navy girls and their white hat and so forth. We did have a dress uniform later in the summer that was all white for officers, but that took a while. We had good designers, but they had the fashion designers, see. But they came into existence after we did. They tried to improve on the Army, because after all, they were going to be recruiting women too, and they were going for the same workforce.
Did you know any women in the waves or in the Air Force or any of the other women's auxiliaries?
Yeah, I had an opportunity to know a number of them, and I've met them over the years. And it's interesting, too.
Did they serve in Europe at the same time as you?
Waves did not serve abroad.
Okay.
They didn't go abroad. The Army allowed us abroad. We had them both in the Pacific and in the European theater. Mm-hmm. Not in combat, but they were abroad, whereas the Navy didn't. Until later, now they do. Of course, now you have women that are pilots. They're flying the jets. They're doing everything in position and doing very well. and I've known a number of the women over the years, had opportunity, just because I've kept interest in the military, that have been the current leaders in the leadership positions, which I've just swelled with pride. Got all that talent out there because they made good careers out of it.
Did you ever notice or take issue with limitations imposed on you by being a woman, or did you ever?
I never really had that problem.
Mm-hmm.
When I think about the discrimination of women, yes, there was, and there was jealousy, and I can understand that. And I'm told our local Kentucky recruiters had a difficult time because the men were downing the women. So I mean, they were spreading very uncomplimentary stories, of which there was not often very much basis for it to be a real story as such. So I was trying to think of an example. Or, and I'll take Washington, D.C., when I was assigned to the Office of the Quartermaster General. And our cubicles for our office space, my secretary was seated right beside me. There was a young lady who was black from Ohio, and she had come into Washington to be a civil service worker. Washington, D.C. was not integrated. She had come in to be as a civilian work, and she turned out to be very, very good. She had had her own business, and I think had owned a beauty parlor, and was quite capable. Good. Well, my colonel had a full-time secretary, but she was often too tired the next day to do her work quite properly, and so he wanted a second secretary. And so he wanted to take my Eleanor, which he had every right to do. Couldn't buck that. And I thought that was a nice honor for her, in a way. But at any rate, I said, you know, she knows that nobody in this whole building wanted to take her as a civil service secretary. She was one of the very first black women to try to come into the D.C. area, which was highly integrated. I would appreciate it, count it as a favor, if you would ask her if she would like to do that, rather than just assigning her as a name on a roster and moving, which is often the way you got your information, you'd been switched. So he did, and she declined him. She said, Colonel, I know I wasn't wanted here when I came to D.C., and I know Captain Holliker was the only woman officer you had in the whole place, and she was took me, and we've had a great working relationship, and if it works out on your agenda and so on, I'd really like for you to consider leaving me where I am. Now, granted, she had the right kind of words to use on her declining, too, so that may have helped, but that's the only chance I've had.
Can you talk a little bit about dating in the military, what that was like?
Anytime you wanted a date, you could have had a date.
Anytime
you wanted to get married, you could get married. I could pull out a nice little roster of some offers along the way, and felt very honored with it. It was up to you on dating as to who you wanted to, but there were plenty of opportunities. And naturally, there were so many fewer women and so forth. There was rank in the military. If you were a commissioned officer, you were expected to date a commissioned officer and not a non-commissioned officer. If you were an enlisted person, it was also. And we had several couples, my friends who'd gone in the military, their husbands were non-commissioned and they'd been commissioned. Now they had to get special permit when they would have leave together. When I was thinking of one of them, when he came in for leave, he had to have special permission in order to room with his wife, because she was commissioned and he was a non-commissioned officer. So there was distinction there on dating.
So she outranked him?
Because she outranked him.
Mm-hmm.
We had a number of women who outranked their husbands on it. On the other hand, we had a lot of women whose husbands were high-ranking military officers and had come into the service. My dad, we're talking about race, and I know you've long since expired your time, but I think it's interesting to note that Eleanor Roosevelt, who was then the wife of the President of the United States, was very strong strongly in favor of integration. And the creation of the WAC, she was right there in the very beginning supporting the formation, but she wanted the equal rights for the women and did a lot for helping us integrate. So in our very first officer candidate class, one reason why some of us were probably in the second class instead of the first is that they took an entire group of black women and moved them into the very first officer candidate class. They might have done that anyway. I'm not privy to know how they selected them, but it was pretty obvious. And if an invitation came from a WAC officer who was black in Washington, those of us that were Caucasian and so on were all expected to go to that event. I mean, you replied in the affirmative, you would go. I mean, there was that interplay, and it was understood. And Mrs. Roosevelt was one of the big movers and shakers on the integration. And it wasn't until after World War II that your army became integrated, but it did in the 70s, I believe. I have to ask our teacher here. She's got all the dates, I'm sure, on her history class, but it came afterwards, which is, in a way, women led the way on segregation in one area. Something to think about, too, isn't it?
Mom maybe mentioned Frank, your friend Frank, who lived in New York City, and how you treated the doorman. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, that's another. Yeah, I had one of the fellas that I dated quite a bit while I was stationed at Fort Meade and in Washington was originally from New York City and lived there on Central Park. So when we'd go to his home, to the big townhouse, it got so that I knew the doorman at the door when we'd go in on the weekend or so on and so forth, howdy with his family and so on and so forth. And so George turned around to me and snapped at me, and he says, "Helen, we don't speak to our service people at the doors." And I said, "George," or whatever his name was, "I don't know what you do in New York City, but in Kentucky, we speak with pleasure to all of the people that we work with." He just got me going, you know, on it and so forth. But yeah, I got a pretty good reprimand that I wasn't supposed to personally be acknowledging the doorman at the high rise there on Central Park.
Oh, your husband, he was in the Army too, you said.
He was in the Army, but I didn't meet him until after I'd started working in Louisville. I met him on the blind date through my sister, who was dating his roommate. Yeah. Right. And he disliked the military immensely. There wasn't a thing he liked about it. He was older when he was pulled out of the regular army and sent to West Point, and he did not want to go to West Point, and he'd already been through all the basic trainings and everything. So with that, he was not that much of a admirer of the system of the military. So he supported whatever I did as one of those rare women veterans around, I guess, but was never active in any of the activities or so forth. And I wasn't either. I really didn't join any of the patriotic groups other than the Daughters of the American Revolution. And I have worked in their patriotic areas on committees and so forth nationally. But I must have pumped you tight. I know you're tired of talking here, girls.
No, this is interesting. That's awesome.
What do you usually do for Veterans Day?
Veterans Day, I grew up doing it, so it wasn't anything new. But my parents both supported Memorial Day and Veterans Day, which at one time was always on November the 11th, the Armistice Day of World War I. And each of them respectively had been state presidents of the American War Mothers and American War Fathers along the way. And those organizations presented wreaths, military wreaths, both at the entrance of the University of Kentucky semicircle driveway where there's a marker, and there's also one on our courthouse. So I grew up expecting that you go to those ceremonies. But in more recent years, and with my own family and having a family, we usually went to the Lexington Cemetery to see the ceremony at the military, formerly open federal cemetery. It's a closed federal cemetery now, the Lexington military part. But there are interments there, but it's not part of the federal, but it's land adjacent, and they're entitled to federal markers, but it's not all, like, it's not an active cemetery. The nearest one here is Nelson, mm-hmm. Port Nelson. And I don't know, thinking about Center and Danville area, if there's military cemetery closer around there, I'm not certain. I think there might be.
I think there is.
Yeah, I think there is too.
It's between here and, it's near Nicholasville, I think.
Yeah. Not Garrett.
That's Camp Nelson.
Camp Nelson.
That is Camp Nelson.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. It takes seven of us to make a city here to get this get this straight, right.
When you were in Germany, did you feel safe? Did you wish that you could carry a gun?
Did I wish I could what?
Carry a weapon?
No, no.
You felt safe?
I was happy not to have that responsibility. Yeah. Don't know that I adapted too well with that type of a weapon as such. I guess I would have or could have, but it didn't bother me that I didn't have a weapon. I had mace and other things, but I didn't have a weapon as such.
How did you communicate with your family back home?
Writing of email letters, you know, the mail, Victrient letters. Mm-hmm. You know, the little ones that were reduced in size by the post office, you'd write it just on one page and send them. And then also I could send letters of used onion skin paper, which is a real thin paper that was used in typing in those days to make copies. Mm-hmm. And I have a set of letters that were written on onion skin paper along the way too. In fact, one of the fellows that I dated in Washington had become an amputee, but he still wanted to be in service. He had an older brother that had already been killed, and he wanted to do it. So they found a job for him in Washington where he could work as a single amputee and so on. But he saved the letters that I wrote. And what was about 6 or 7 years ago, I had a phone call from New York City, and they were trying to track down somebody, and they'd gone through the university, and you know, universities won't forward things direct, they'll just let you know about them. And so he got in touch and said that he was clearing out his things, and he had copies of all the letters that I had written while I was stationed there, and would I like to have them? Well, they're not very many. I did get them, and he sent them to me. But he was an engineer, and he, along in the margins, had drawn off in pencil where he thought I was stationed, trying to figure it out, and so forth. Just trying to keep up where they were sending me in Europe. I thought that was an interesting letter.
What do you think about how people remember World War II versus how you remember World War II?
I think it's awfully easy to forget about a war, mm-hmm. once we're not in it, and especially when we don't have immediate families in it. Now, if you know people that are in combat, then you perk up a little bit more. But right now, we sail along, and the six of us are having a delightful afternoon, and we're not at all concerned about the person that's just been sent to the Pacific, or the person that's fighting still over there in Afghanistan, or the one that was killed last week that we may know about. I mean, it doesn't affect us quite the same way. So immediate involvement and personality, I think, has a lot to do with your interest. Unless you're a history major and really trying to get it all in line or something. You think you've got done us?
I think a lot.
Well, you've just asked some great questions. I thank you both for having an afternoon and coming over and spending time, and photographer getting us all set up, and and the teacher getting the right permit slip, and all to go to making a couple of hours interesting for me too, to get to know you.
Gosh, well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This was wonderful. Mm-hmm.